You're listening to a podcast from the RSA. You can find out more about RSA events and projects and how to get involved with the fellowship by visiting our website, thersa.org.
I'm Rowan Conway. I'm Director of Innovation and Development here at the RSA, and it's my great pleasure to introduce this evening's event, which is presented as part of the RSA's Design Association in partnership with Innovate UK. Last year, we celebrated the 80th anniversary of the Royal Designers for Industry. The RDIs are responsible for designing the world around us, enriching our cultural heritage, driving innovation, inspiring creativity in others, and improving our quality of life. It's their work that includes great industrial designs such as the jet engine, the Routemaster bus, and the iPhone. So as the home of the Royal Designers for Industry, we're delighted to be working in partnership with Innovate UK to explore critical issues in relation to the government's emerging industrial strategy and how design might contribute to innovation in the UK. So it's my great pleasure to introduce this evening's speaker, Professor Jeremy Myerson, to talk about how social challenges can catalyse design-led innovation in industry. Jeremy is an academic and author focusing on design and innovation. He is the Helen Hamlin Professor, and that's very hard to say, I have to say, of design at the Royal College of Art, hard to do, probably much harder to do. And he's director of the WorkTech Academy, a new global knowledge network that explores the future of the workplace. He's also a visiting fellow in the Oxford Institute for Population Ageing at the University of Oxford. Jeremy tells me that he last gave a lecture here in the Great Hall in 1992, where he must have been a mere schoolboy, because it's at least 25 years, extraordinary. So we are delighted to welcome him back and have him here tonight to help us further explore how social challenges can be reframed as creative opportunities for change. I'll be joining Jeremy later for a discussion, and we're looking forward to hearing your questions. But without further ado, let's get started. So please join me in welcoming Jeremy Myerson.
Well, good evening, everybody, and thank you, Rowan. And it is true, I did give a lecture here in 1992. It was on the centenary of the birth of Gordon Russell, who's an RDI, and I was his biographer, and the seats were raked. But of course, 1992, 25 years ago, was a very, very different place. There was a Conservative government threatening the European Union in those days. What I'd like to do this evening is, as part of my contribution to this lecture series on the future of design for industry, is to look at how social challenges, and, you know, we have enough of them, can be a catalyst for design and innovation. And although most of my comments are going to be about the future, I do want to start in the fog of the past. And I mean that literally. In smog-filled Los Angeles of the 1940s, to be precise, with this very cheerful group of postal delivery workers. Now, you may recall the reason why LA is called Smog Town, because in 1943, a thick haze suddenly descended over the city. Now, we're used to very high levels of air pollution in London, but this was right through the roof. It was incredible. And the cause was unknown until a chemist at the California Institute of Technology in Pasadena, a man called Ari Hagen-Schmidt, solved the mystery in the early 50s. The deadly haze, which affected all daily life, consisted mainly of ozone formed by actions of sunlight on the emissions that spewed from the myriad of car exhausts. And remember, this was a city which the automobile industry had run the railway companies out of town in the 1930s. So it was traffic, not factories, that caused the smog. And by the time the scientists had worked all that out, an entire industry of design innovation had grown up around poor air quality, gas masks, air filtration systems, screens, and so on. So this is an extreme example, perhaps, of a social challenge generating a creative design response. But the mail still got delivered, kids still went to school, but it took until the 1970s for legislation to be introduced to curb the smog-making vehicle emissions. And LA, in common with many other world cities, still has very poor air quality. But even in Los Angeles, a Babylon of capitalism, social drivers of design change could not be ignored. So Historically, one can find lots of examples of social imperatives driving design forward. Walter Gropius, shown here, social visionary, founder of the Bauhaus. He was made an honorary RDI in 1947. He developed his modern design approach amid the tumultuous political changes of Weimar Germany, people taking home their salary in a wheelbarrow and a desperate need for new worker housing. And he said that design is simply an integral vision of the stuff of everyday life, necessary for everyone in a civilized society. And you might compare his approach with that of Raymond Loewy, the New York-based industrial design showman, who was made an honorary RDI 8 years earlier in 1939. So the Royal Designers honored Loewy before they honored Gropius. And this self-styled man who shaped America had an avowed commercial aim to streamline the sales curve. And you can see here some of his greatest work, the Greyhound bus, the Coca-Cola bottle, and so on. Well, both Gropius's Bauhaus and Loewy's American School of Design Consulting had a profound effect on post-war design, both in Britain and internationally. And in a sense, their influences became entwined. But by the mid-60s, the commercial programs were winning out over social context as a driver of innovation. And you may remember a design supergroup of the 60s and 70s, Unimark International. They were headquartered in Chicago. And even though they had the former Bauhaus director Herbert Baer on their board as a kind of nod to social utopianism, it was in the vanguard of a process that I have called abstraction and scaling up, two of the keynote features of late 20th century design. Just think Unimark's Ford logo, which was rolled out in the 60s and 70s. And the eminent graphic designer, Catherine McCoy, who worked at Unimark in 1968 and wrote of her experiences of how in a year of the Detroit riots, Vietnam protests, and the assassinations of both Robert Kennedy and Martin Luther King, she said, "Hardly a word was spoken on these subjects. We were encouraged to wear white lab coats, perhaps so the messy external environment would not contaminate our surgically clean detachment." And she described the white lab coats as an excellent metaphor for the apolitical designer, cherishing the myth of universal value-free design. And it was a myth, because this was a period of huge social dislocation. But this is what design became. The Bauhaus, in a sense, through Unimark, caving in to big business. And even Victor Papinek's spirited intervention in 1972 with Design for the Real World, which promoted such social challenges as environmental degradation, third world poverty, discrimination against women, and aging populations as worthy contexts for design. Even Papinek could not stop the flow. In fact, he was kicked out of the Industrial Designers Society for America for opening his book with this comment: "There are professions more harmful than industrial design, but only a very few of them." And he added, "Never before in human history have grown men sat down and seriously designed electric hairbrushes, rhinestone-covered file boxes, and mink carpeting for bathrooms, and then drawn up elaborate plans to make and sell these gadgets to millions of people." The irony is that Papinek has never been more current today. The things he was talking about in 1972, which was the first English language publication, it was originally first published in Swedish, because no English language publisher would touch it before Thames and Hudson. He is very current with what's happening now. So by the 1980s, design was drawn away from social contexts and into a kind of vortex of conspicuous consumption and big bangs in the city, a tool for commerce and marketing. And I myself must own up to some form in this area. In 1986, I was the launch editor of a magazine, Design Week, with its own share watch box for design firms on the stock exchange. Who won what contract was the big news every week. And Design Week would print weekly for over 25 years and lives on today as an online platform. But at the same time as Design Week was launching, there was a groundbreaking exhibition at the Boiler House space in the V&A, forerunner to the Design Museum. New Design for Old was curated by Helen Hamlin and Elizabeth Henderson, and it took a social challenge, keeping older people independent in their own home, as the catalyst for design innovation. Helen commissioned 15 well-known international product designers, many of them RDIs, including David Meller did cutlery, Kenneth Grange rethought the shower from first principles. Vico Magistretti and Dinah Casson teamed up, all of them in the Royal Designers for Industry, to rethink the stepladder. And Vuko Nummasimme, the Finnish fashion designer, produced easy-to-wear clothing for older people. Although I don't think these models look a day over 25. But New Design for Old, and I remember going to see it and writing about it in Design Week, had a profound impact. And it led to, in the early 90s, to the establishment of the first Design Age research program and then the Helen Hamlin Centre for Design at the RCA. And it pointed in a different design direction, one towards social challenge. And if you remember, in the early 90s, growing green ecological movements, it signalled a new respect for context. So 30 years after New Design for Old, last summer, the Helen Hamlin Trust invited me to revisit the original show with a new 21st century version, because in that 30-year period, ageing has really moved on. It's accelerated, and New Old has opened at the New Design Museum in Kensington in January and has just finished its UK tour prior to its UK run prior to an international tour. So if you want to go and see it, I'm afraid it's not there. But there is a wonderful exhibition on Russia in its place, so go and look at that. And as with 30 years ago, our aim was to encourage designers and industry to think about an ageing society, to think about our future selves, to design for our future selves, and look through the eyes of older people and to respond. And the big question of New Old was really about how can design enhance the experience of later life? How can we make it richer, healthier, and more rewarding? What can design and designers do? And that old Japanese saying, if you throw a stone, it will hit a senior. Now, it really does apply to the UK, where over the next 25 years, 70% of population growth will be in the over 60 age range. Although I was a schoolboy last time I spoke in this room, I have crept over the magic 60 barrier, and I'm now very, very interested in design for older people because there are more pensioners in this country than there are teenagers. So the exhibition combined demographic data from the Government Office for Science. They've done a big foresight report made into huge super graphics by Lucien Roberts, combined with existing projects and six special commissions from design groups. And it was seen by over 80,000 people during its run. As my son said to me, "Ah, but Dad, it was free." But it was seen by a lot of people. And it's instructive to compare the new show with the original version. And, of course, back in, you can see here, actually, this is a section on stigma and stereotypes. And you can see on the right of the screen some redesigns of that stereotypical elderly road sign. And you can see at the top there, Margaret Calvert. And I don't know, Margaret, yes, you're here. Margaret Calvert redesigned the elderly road sign and based it on the children's sign, which she originally designed many moons ago, based on her a picture of her and her brother. And there they are again in older age. What's interesting about this show is that the 80s was largely about product design and product design for the home. The new version has a much broader view of aging. And it's interesting, in the new show we put Harmut Esslinger's original swiveling television that was designed in 1986. And this was so that older people could watch television in bed lying down. And this was seen as the ultimate ambition for older people in their own homes, that they could watch telly in bed. Whereas the new exhibition has sections on identity, mobility, working, community, much more about getting out into the world. And the design disciplines are broader too, not just product or fashion, but interiors, transport, service, interaction and experience design, and explorations of robotics, material science and artificial intelligence. So when you go into the exhibition, and this was the poster girl for the show in a sense, this is the Aura powered suit by Yves Bihar, a very talented designer working with a Silicon Valley startup called Superflux. This is based on American military technology, and it's a life-altering intelligent garment with motors, sensors, AI embedded into a responsive system, provides support for the user's torso, hips and legs, and it reacts to the body's natural movement. It adds through electric power to your own muscle power to complement the user's strength in getting up, sitting down or staying upright. And it's attracted a huge amount of interest. In fact, the Times called it the Grand Kini, rather unhelpfully. But it is a brilliant kind of undergarment in which these hexagonal pads can be removed so the garment can be cleaned. And following the Times article, I was rung up by Roger Bannister of the 4 Minute Mile, who's now in his 80s, and said, "I want one." And he's an eminent clinician, and he had all kinds of questions for the design team, and he's now working with them on the next iteration. So there was a nice link in the exhibition between Sebastian Conran, who was 30 when in 1986 when he designed a bedside table, a flipping bedside table. We invited him back 30 years later, and the bedside table is an intelligent table that's part of a digital robotic system of assistive support. It's called the Carefree Home System, designed with Consequential Robotics, a Sheffield University spin-out, in which there are a number of features, including Miro, a robot dog, which is acts as a kind of companion. And so what you've got is this whole kind of smart service of five interacting elements, helpfully labelled A, B, C, D, E, the assistant table, the bracelets, the companion dog, a data hub attached to the television, and an e-sensor that's just like a smoke alarm in the ceiling. And it was interesting how in 30 years, an inanimate table has become part of a robotic system. And we pushed on further into this idea of opening a debate about the role of technology in future care and support for older people. This is IDEO, a project called Spirit, which we commissioned. It's set 30 years in the future, in 2047. And it's about how we might design stronger communities in which older people feel more attachment, and it's addressing the public epidemic of loneliness. And Spirit is this AI assistant that you swallow, nanobots race around your body. And this is anticipating. We already give a lot of data away to Google and Facebook about what we buy and who we're talking to. This is actually monitoring our vital functions inside our body and marrying that with the data that we're doing through social media to create a complete profile. And then other spirit users get matched with you. So this is an AI system which knows who you should hang out with better than you know yourself. Scary stuff, and there's all kinds of extreme reactions to it, but it was one of the most thought-provoking pieces in the exhibition. And then we had Sam Hecht and Kim Collin, RDIs. They have a research arm of industrial facility called Future Facility, and they did a project called Amazing Apartments, in which it was a fictional scenario in which a technology company, Amazon, is both property developer and manager of a serviced apartment block. And this is about older residents not struggling when they're out of food or the washing machine breaks down. And so what you've got is a series of modules, and you can see three here, a kind of standing height washing machine, a fridge, and a water cooler. And they are plugged into your apartment. And on the other side of the wall, and you could see both sides in the exhibition, is a service corridor. And there is a service corridor. And it's a bit like Downton Abbey or the Palace of Versailles, where you've got a hidden corridor where servants scuttle along. And your fridge opens both ways. So, you know, when you're out of milk and eggs, it mysteriously, you've signed the service contract, it mysteriously gets stocked up. When you've when you put your washing in, it comes back beautifully clean and ironed. And of course, it's a story around how technology companies could do better than property developers, especially if they're doing this on a worldwide basis and collecting lots and lots and aggregating lots and lots of data. And of course, in the scenario, you've got human beings actually doing the data analysis and stocking everything up. But of course, in the future, it might be kind of robots. And again, this opened a huge debate about whether this stopped older people popping down the shop for a pint of milk and therefore reduced, it removed a lot of stress, but it removed social interaction. And you could contrast this type of project. This is a project called Exchange, which is in the exhibition for 3 hours every day. We created this kind of living art installation where older people were themselves the exhibits and young people could go and talk to them. And they wrote down their conversations in paper on a paper tabletop. And this is by Clara Gajero Westaway and Adrian Westaway, one of the most popular parts of the exhibition. And it was addressing stigma and stereotypes. And we actually persuaded Helen Hamlin herself to actually be a living exhibit. And we also have the world's oldest supermodel, who's now in her 90s, Clara? She's 88, yeah. She enjoyed being a living work of art. And of course, it was very, very interesting. This was all about people rather than robots. And Konstantin Gritsch, who's an honorary doc, RDI, he, in a section on working, he created this mesh structure that's actually based, it's taken its inspiration from the painting by Antonello da Messina in the National Gallery from 1475, St. Jerome in his study. The idea is that older people are not retreating from the world, but going out to face it. And then there was the final special commission. We commissioned Priestman Good, who do Airbus and trains, to rethink the mobility scooter. And they came up with this idea of scooter for life, which enables... they recognise that kids and young adults use micro-scooters. So why not have a stable three-wheeled scooter in which you can move around? You can take it into shops, you can put your shopping in it. When you're tired, it's got an electric motor, so you don't have to push, but you can push if you're feeling okay. And it allows grandparents to interact directly with their micro-scooter riding grandchildren using a new flexible type of vehicle. So what the exhibition did, and you can see here the idea of a single module growing from a child's plaything to a mobility scooter, it opened a debate about whether technical advances in digital networks, robotics and artificial intelligence will replace human contact and support because it's expensive. And that's one camp. And then there's another camp which believes that design for an aging society should be about encouraging more social interaction and not less. And we had a participation element which kind of addressed all of those things. And it's interesting how when you set design in the context of social challenge, you get a plurality of view, you get different perspectives. And probably, you know, the way to go is a mashup between things which encourage human interaction and replacing human interaction in those moments, and especially at a time of growing fears over our social care budget. So, in a sense, in curating the exhibition, I was very influenced by a famous exhibition which came to London in the early 1980s, curated by Jens Bernsen, who was then the director of the Danish Design Council, called The Problem Comes First. And I've always felt that Scandinavian design has been very alert to social context. It has some of the most successful commercial companies in the world, but their starting point is not trying to find a market gap. It is looking at the social fabric and trying to understand people. And the exhibition was fabulous because it looked at Lego toys and Bang & Olufsen and Louis Poulsen lights. And my favourite case study was Velux. At a time when, you know, in the 1920s and 30s, when Europe had a lot of unrest and housing crisis and they needed to make loft rooms habitable, it was Velux engineers who patented a system that putting a light into a roof line, that they recognised that you didn't just need light, but you needed air, so the window needed to open. And that was the point at which they got ahead of the game with a patented mechanism, which has enabled them to be a very, very successful company. So this idea of social challenge as a driver of innovation has been at the heart of the work I've recently stood down as director of the Helen Hamid Centre for Design after 16 years. But in many of our projects, whether reducing healthcare costs or trying to cut down medical errors in hospitals or creating sustainable workplaces, that has been the essential approach. And I just thought this evening I'd share with you a project which we're currently working on. So this is absolutely fresh. It's ongoing, but it's quite exciting and encapsulates some of the points that I've tried to put across. This is centred on the River Foyle in Derry, Londonderry, in Northern Ireland. And this is a project that's led by designers Ralph Alwani and Lizzie Raby from the Helen Hamlin Centre for Design, working with Public Health Northern Ireland and a whole host of other partners. And the lower bridges on the River Foyle are black spots for suicide. And, you know, the whole well-being of the community there is affected by, you know, it's a bit like Archway Bridge and, you know, the various places around England that get a reputation for suicidal behaviour. So the aim of the project was design and community interventions to rebrand the area for suicide prevention and to improve community well-being. And the city has a very emotive relationship with its river. I'm ready for the foil is one of those sayings which they kind of say, you know, used in jest, but highlights underlying stigma around suicidal behaviour. So the project team have been working over the last couple of years on a series of public consultations, events, workshops, in-depth study with all kinds of individuals from different communities and ages to get an insight into their perceptions of the river. And the strategy they came up with There's a media campaign, there's a digital platform, but they really want to reduce suicides on these particular kind of bridges. And the strategy which was developed this is called the Foil Suicide Prevention Triangle. And the inside layers focus on the mental health needs of the community. And the outer triangle, they're looking at physical barriers, soft barriers, and increasing footfall, because natural surveillance, people being in the area and on the bridge and going there because it's a destination and a community public realm space, which is pleasant, is a very, very good way to deter suicides. So there's lots of different elements, but they're developing something called foil bubbles, which are a series of satellite spaces designed to house arts, commercial, educational and well-being activities on the riverfront. And they're movable to respond to the needs of the banks and the bridges. And so we're lining the river with these foil bubbles. And here you can see in the specks of light the bubbles as beacons acting as a public realm object, moving and responding to disconnected areas and negative spaces within the area. And to complement the bubbles, we've got foil reeds. And this is a physical suicide barrier intended for a 864-metre-long bridge within the city. And prevention barriers are commonly known for enforcing stigma around suicide, and they sometimes imprison the city as a result with very high steel bars and so on. So through public consultation and observation, the design team took the concept of the reeds that line the riverbank, and they created the concept of the foil reed bridge. And the installation combines the visual language of the local fauna with interactive lighting to create a preventative barrier against suicidal behaviour, as well as becoming an icon for locals and tourists alike. And those walking past the installation can engage in a sensory experience as the reeds change colour and brightness. And the community ownership of the bridge will be reinforced by the use of an app, and residents will be able to adopt a reed, which will act as a source of income for other future foil interventions. And so what we're seeing here is a whole business ecosystem of new products and services and apps which will surround this public sphere intervention to create a healthier city. And negotiations are ongoing with lighting manufacturers, the operators of a floating cinema, and so on. And what's happening on the River Foyle in partnership with Public Health Northern Ireland and in plenty of other communities around the world is indicative of wider change for how design for industry might work in the future. Social challenge scaled to specific communities will be the catalyst for design innovation. And it's a very different world from the abstracted, scaled up, rolled out design programs of the late 20th century, a kind of homogenous consumer world with which we're all too familiar. We're looking now for more diversity, more authenticity, for more specific kind of local solutions. Everything from offices to shops to products. And this puts huge emphasis on design to be driven by this new intermix of new technologies and civic interests, a mix of the digital, physical, a mix of the public and private, in which the old design, brief, client, commercial relationship begins to dissolve. So, to conclude with a few thoughts about the future. I'm very aware. I once wrote a leader in Design Week saying that just before the crash of 1989, I said that the horizon was sunny and we were set for even greater growth. So I'm very hesitant about making predictions, but some predictions you can make. So here are kind of six ideas about the future. And the first one is really about scaling down, not scaling up. Moving away from big rollouts to much more site and context-sensitive projects like the River Foyle project I showed you. And you can see here, these are products designed by two Royal College of Art researchers. They're products for autistic adults. Not a huge market, not a mainstream market, but products that are being customized. And we're going to see scaling down for the specific needs of people in the future. The next aspect is engagement, not abstraction. And using real people and having co-design and co-creation processes, not personas. I used to go into car styling studios and they'd have Lara Croft on the wall. You know, that's our typical consumer of this sports car, they'd say. I said, what's typical about Lara Croft? What's interesting about abstraction, it was very useful in the late 20th century. Don't be too specific, don't be too local, don't be too characterful, don't tie anything to a recognisable tradition, because that means you can sell wherever and whenever to whoever. So the whole point is to mean just enough to the greatest number of people to get them to purchase, or at the very least, not to cause offence. You know, the term vanilla solutions, which is widely used in office design, you know, it's a design that doesn't arouse passions either way, so you get away with it. That's all changing. We need to engage with real people. And we need, you know, and I saw this from the New Old exhibition, where it was teams that were working on these projects, not an individual making a chair or making a piece of cutlery. It's integrated teams working in an interdisciplinary way, not the solo effort of some hero designer. The ability to work in teams and make these teams as broad as possible with social scientists, with engineers, with behavioural experts, with material experts, bring in as many different perspectives as possible. And part of those teams, of course, the citizens and communities who are going to receive the design. Incredibly important. And within the process itself, citizen-centred and not producer-driven. A lot of systems, even healthcare systems, which are meant to, you know, help people and cure people, are actually producer-driven. Hospitals are designed, you know, on a whole load of clinical processes, actually looking at what the patient has to do, how many times they have to go to outpatients, you know, to get different tests done. Once you start mapping things from the patient's point of view, things become very, very different. I just thought I'd show you the Helen Hamlin Centre's redesign of the ambulance, which rethought the whole experience of being an ambulance from first principles around the needs of patients to make it safer, cleaner, and less intimidating, and paramedics. So they've got the right kit in the right place using modular treatment packs and 360-degree access to the patient. So we're entering a world where one size fits one, not one size fits all. We have, with 3D printing, with digital manufacture, with the way that digital platforms can help us research the early stage of the design process, we can actually start to tailor and personalise things rather than finding the lowest common denominator, which will attract a large number of people. So this is about personalising the experience. And finally, it's about responding to the changing world in which we live. The social contexts, you know, if you just take air quality in London, or if you take the rising costs in the healthcare or the social care system. These are powerful contexts, and we can build innovation ecosystems with entrepreneurial startups and scale-ups and large companies all working together around these social challenges. And we need to make social context the baseline for design for industry, from green energy right the way through to this idea of the healthy city. Because if we don't, we're going to need those Los Angeles gas masks. Thank you very much.
Thank you so much for that food for thought on the future of design for industry. You've offered us a wide variety of challenges to think about there. And it applies to the whole of society. I mean, you've talked about the ageing population. I like the idea of if you throw a stone, you'll hit a senior somewhere in the UK. I'm hoping no one will take that as a challenge. But as you say, if we start with ageing as this arena that you've looked at, you know, this ageing population is a prime opportunity for designers. 70% of the UK population. Is that now?
No. 70% of population growth will be in the over 60s. Okay. Yes. We're going to have fewer younger people and more older people.
For a while.
Mm.
I don't know.
And, you know, our longevity, you know, mortality rates are falling, fertility rates are falling as well, sperm count is down.
I'm thinking about the challenges and opportunities of this 100-year life.
Yeah.
You know, you talked about some the Grand Kini and some of these exciting sort of intelligent garments. Mm. But actually, what are the other associated challenges of this 100-year life? You know, you talked a little bit about social care. What can you imagine arising as challenges designers need to?
We're in unprecedented territory. Actually, the country with the low... I gave a talk... a while ago, and I said to the audience, who can tell me which country has got the lowest birth rate? And somebody said, the Vatican. But it is South Korea, actually. No, we're in unprecedented territory, and it's quite clear. And you know, governments around the world have looked at the predictions. The big issue is the dependency ratio. Who's in work, and who is, and you know, still paying taxes into the system and being economically productive, and who is on welfare, who are being cared for, and the dependency ratios are horrendous. You know, we're going to have a shrinking workforce and far more older people who are not working, and so the push now is not. You know, that's why there hasn't been the movements in care homes and you know, what you might call fragile care. And the big movement is longer working lives and adapting the workplace and more training and age discrimination. We've got to keep people healthier and working for longer. And we need a health system which isn't just about curing age as a disease, but helping but being much more preventative and taking the steps now so that people are healthier in the future, because the dependency ratios don't work.
Living more active lives and potentially still working. I mean, it's interesting you talk about social challenges being the catalyst for design innovation, and that is asking for a new method or new way of doing design, and very much an engagement-led, driven way of doing design. I think... You know, you said design can no longer be remote, and it made me think with some of your images around the phrase that's often used in NHS England patient engagement of no decision about me without me. Yeah. If this applies to design too, and we really are doing citizen-driven design, what kind of new skill set do designers need to have to be able to do that kind of work?
I think designers are already broadening out their skill set. Designers have... The core design training is incredibly useful in interdisciplinary teams. Designers don't need to become social scientists, but you can actually, and this is what we've done, you know, for 20-odd years in the Helen Hammond Centre, is give people just enough social science training to know how to do observations, ethnographic encounters, interviews properly, analyse the data, present it. You don't need to go native as a social science researcher, but it's very powerful when the designer experiences what it's like and then can go straight into a design process, rather than sitting in the studio, listening to music, drinking lattes, and then getting a report thrown over the wall from a social science consultancy to say, design something because we've seen these behaviours. And so it's actually, and especially with maker culture at the other end, so the front-end designers are active in the front-end of discovery, and they're also active because the tools of manufacture and fabrication and making are more flexible and the barriers to entry are lower. Designers are spreading from the kind of development phase. They're going upstream into the discovery phase, and they're going downstream into the delivery phase. They're widening their repertoire.
Okay. You talked about designing to a level of scale that was talking about context and actually applying to real social problems. And there was a question that arose for me there was about actually where are the markets, and are the markets really there, or the sectors there to sort of commission this work? Mm. Because you said, you know, we're not just responding to gaps in the market or spotting gaps in the market, but we're actually trying to address social challenges. Mm. But does the money flow follow that?
Well, I'm not saying that, you know, everyone's going to get by just doing very site-specific, you know, they're going to design, you know, on the River Foyle, a lighting manufacturer, a large international one probably, will develop those interactive, you know, reeds. They won't just, you know, and on the Foyle, they'll be shaped like reeds, but the technology will be adapted and used elsewhere. It's using the local and the specific and the scaled down intensity of engagement with communities to actually test an innovation, and then you can scale up and you can offer it in different ways. And we're beginning to see that.
It's not the mass customization for Lara Croft. That no longer exists.
No, it's real people rather than personas.
No, I like that. So I'm going to go to the audience. So if you raise your hands, we'll go to the lady here in the front first. Mm-hmm.
Amazing lecture. Totally agree with a lot of the things that you said. And one difficult part for me, because outside of doing what I'm doing, I'm also having a privilege of lecturing at London College of Fashion, predominantly to visual merchandising and branding students. And one biggest challenge is, because I actually lecture in consumer psychology, one biggest challenge for them is, because of the way they're being educated, and it's actually visible on every single sort of university studies, anything, or even within professionals in design, is the awful focus all the time on the brand or the product or the space, rather than actually using that just purely as a tool to influence and design certain emotions, behaviors, or decisions within people. So how do you think education should be changed for us to be able to actually educate future designers so they're not focusing on prettiness or, you know, shapes or colors or whatever, but actually they're designing reactions as opposed to products or spaces?
Well, I've actually no objection to kind of, I think, you know, brands are brands drive business, and I've no objection to things being pretty, but they really do need to meet needs. You know, you can have great new trainers, but I think it's very important that design students know that, you know, if you're buying a trainer for $29.99, you know, what are the conditions in which it's being made? What's happening to the local economies where the materials are being sourced? What's the process by which they're being distributed? And what kinds of stories are the brands? We need design education. And I think design education has done a pretty good job on the kinds of things I've been talking about, looking at social design and looking at the underlying context. We need to bring a critical lens to the whole innovation manufacturing process. You know, you can have the best Nike trainers in the world, but if you're still throwing yourself off the bridge into the River Foyle, you know, that's not a healthy society.
Do you think this sort of post-globalization world, kind of new manufacturers and local manufacturers, is actually part of the reason why we're getting this reaction from sort of de-globalization?
I think you're absolutely right. And we are in a... You know, politically, we're in a deglobalization world. You know, Britain and America have just taken momentous political decisions based on the fact that globalization isn't working for a lot of people, because you get local industries and communities marooned. And you can argue about you know, populist demagogues taking advantage of that and so on and so forth. But people are generally are looking more. Instead of saying, you know, I work a lot in, I run something called the WorkTech Academy, so I spend a lot of my time looking at office design and the workplace and how it's formulated. It's a big interest of mine. And it was all I could do tonight to not show any offices and stop, not bore you all to death. But the interesting thing is that, you know, 10 years ago, I would, you know, a global head of facilities would say, we're rolling out our global corporate standards. And you could go into, you know, a multinational, a Hewlett-Packard office in Shanghai and be exactly the same as the one in San Francisco. That doesn't happen now. The days of the big, slick global rollout are over. It's a process of de-globalization. You want to know where you are. You want to source local furniture. You want to have local textiles. You want local food. So something is going on. And corporations are really struggling to adapt. And which is why a lot of people like to go into the startup world, because they can do a test innovation and then try and scale it up. So I think it is a symptom of post-globalization.
Thank you for your very interesting presentation. You've inferred, but never actually used the phrase, which I always consider, fitness for purpose. That is absolutely essential. A lot of what we're given as said to be design is, in fact, just styling. Yeah. And the classic disaster in London is the so-called Boris bus, which has no point of it anywhere. Is there anything that is fit for purpose? Mm. I see at Victoria Station people coming in from Europe, and they're getting onto this bus in the first point, and it tells you, put your card here. It doesn't mean that. It's like below where it says card here. Mm. There's nothing in that bus, and I complained at the prototype of this, and I pointed it out, and even the disabled fraternity pointed it out, and Heatherwick rubbed his hands with glee to say, I've got rid of those yellow handrails. Mm. Yeah. So fitness for purpose is the absolute criteria.
I think that's important. I mean, London Transport actually, you know, Boris Bus aside, London Transport has actually had a tremendous lineage in this. Apart from the sign at the bottom of the escalator which says, dogs must be carried. And then tourists stand there and thinking, how the hell am I going to get a dog?
Thank you. Yeah, just the point about the elderly and the Scandinavian approaches that you talked about. Because the elderly, two things we know that they need to remain well and live longer are social contact, as you pointed out, and movement, remaining mobile. What, in terms of a concrete example in Scandinavia, are there concrete examples of where the Scandinavian approach to design has produced solutions for supporting the appropriate sort of lifestyle for the elderly that delivers movement and social contact?
I would put the city of Copenhagen, certainly the city centre of Copenhagen, as a very, very good example. They, you know, even though the climate is cold, they use the river. There's a lot of cycling. There's a lot of walking. They've had a program in Copenhagen, and it always comes out at top of the kind of happiness index. But the thing about Copenhagen, the town planners worked with public health officials to de-escalate the city, to de-stress the city. You know, they've been very strict about tall buildings. They've been very strict about parks and pathways and lighting. And, you know, the city is very, very well lit at night so people can walk around, and that creates natural surveillance. So my big bugbear in the UK, and I think it has a hugely detrimental effect on older people, is there is a schism in this country between public health officials, the public health professionals, and urban planning professionals. They don't talk to each other. They live in different worlds. In other countries, it's different. Public health officials in this country are so overwhelmed by the demands of drug and drink addiction, they don't look at the social determinants of the built environment, and they should. All right. Yeah. All right. I'm not criticising either camp. I just wish I could lock them in a room.
Firstly, we're going to come to the gentleman here, and then I will be coming to you at the back. So,
if it's the case that increasingly new technologies and business models will make small-scale, personalised solutions more commercially viable. Does that mean that we need to rethink our understanding of what inclusive design means? Is inclusive design actually becoming a redundant term as we actually seek more exclusive solutions?
Challenge.
Well, see, I it depends how you define inclusive design. You know, this morning I shaved with a Gillette razor like 10 billion men in the world, you know, and although my face is very different from other people's faces, you know, one product does all, you know, and I could buy that product very cheaply in, you know, in any airport or shop or anywhere in the world, and it's exactly the same and it does the job, and, you know, lots and lots of science and technology has gone into this very cheap, you know, and you could say it's inclusive. I would say it's just a mass market product. I think you can be inclusive for smaller cohorts of people who you've taken the time to really understand and ethnographically engage with and really do something tailored for them. I think that's inclusive design as well. So I wouldn't confuse a large market with being inclusive. Obviously, you know, things like cars and computers and, you know, they have to be large, global, mass market things. But within them, their features can understand particular cohorts of people.
Ian Dodds, I live near Canary Wharf, and the building that I live in was completed in 1999, and it won a prize for the quality of its architecture. It is a beautiful building with green spaces around it. Since around about 2010, at Canary Wharf, they've been building the most ugly, awful 60-story glass boxes because those are bought by investors and 50% of the apartments in them will not be lived in. And so I just wondered what your comment is on this drive for a design change.
Well, you know, you can go all the way up from Vauxhall, from Battersea, right the way along the river, and it's beginning to look like Pudong, you know, the other side of Shanghai. And yes, glass boxes sold to investors, you know, they don't even bother putting it on the market in London. It's straight to Malaysia and China. Yeah, I mean, there was a very interesting report launched this week. I went to the launch in the Houses of Parliament, and Richard Rogers gave the kind of keynote. It's called People and Place. You can download it online. And it's about design and behaviour. And they collected evidence. They had a group collecting evidence. What was interesting about housing is we have a broken housing system in this country, and the mismatch between what people actually need and what is being delivered and the land banking by developers who are sitting on lots of land, it's very, very distressing. And, of course, you know, I can talk about, you know, social context and underlying, you know, cultural imperatives, but we have some things in this country which are seriously broken. But unless we fix them, the sheer weight of demographic change is going to crush us.
So we won't end on that bleak note. I'm going to go to the lady in the blue.
I'll try and end on a happy note.
I was wondering whether, when you talk about older people, I'm just thinking, is it that the design approach that we've had in the past is reflective of our view as a society that our older people are an inconvenience, or that old age is an inconvenience, instead of old age being an asset and older people being an asset to our society? And do you think that, you know, that could elevate the design challenge and into a fantastic opportunity?
If you look at things through the old lens of market gaps and mass markets and commercial briefs and all the things I was talking about, older people are a very large special needs group for which you do special needs design. And before you know it, you've got, you know, white grab rails that look very clinical out of a hospital. if you break up the world into a series of much more specific communities and try and create design that is post-globalized for those communities, you will arrive at a completely different place. You will arrive at design which is trying to enrich their lives. And that's what some of the people in the exhibition that we commissioned were trying to understand that process. And, you know, if you're in design, you've got to be optimistic. And I am hopeful that, you know, we will get some fantastic new solutions. In the Helen Hamlin Centre, we're working with a company called Oriens, who are developing a care home quite like no other. My fear is that it's going to be very expensive, but it will set a blueprint. It'll be an outlier, but it will feed back into the mainstream. But, you know, gorgeous design is one of the things. You know, they did a lot of research about old people's homes, and they said, you know, what's the one thing you don't want to happen? And I think smell of cabbage came up about 8 times. And but I'm hopeful this is going to be a beautiful exemplar which will open the door to other providers.
Thank you for turning that around. That's fabulous. Sadly, we have, though, run out of time. I could stay here all afternoon or all evening listening to us talk about this. And this has been really, really wonderful food for thought about the future for design for industry and how industry will change with demographic change and the way the world is changing. I'd also like to thank Innovate UK for their support with today's event. But for now, please join me once again in thanking today's terrific speaker, Jeremy Rice.
Thank you for listening. If you enjoyed this podcast, why not download our free app to access video and audio files on the go? Just visit our website, therSA.org, and follow the links to the RSA Vision mobile app.